3. Is the Earth really warming? On February 8, 2001, 19 days after George W. Bush's inauguration as president, ExxonMobil chairman Lee Raymond met with Vice President Dick Cheney in Cheney's West Wing office at the White House. They knew each other very well, as Raymond put it later. Indeed, Raymond had known Cheney for more than two decades, dating back to the period when Cheney was a congressman from Wyoming. They had hunted quail and pheasants together. They were compatible personalities, both reticent, bred on the cold plains of the upper Midwest, and both educated at the University of Wisconsin. They were ardent in their free market views, inclined to a certain tough bluntness, and not very much worried about what others thought about them, particularly by coastal media elites and liberal intelligentsia. During the 1990s, the Cheneys and the Raymonds had lived near one another in the old line Preston Hollow and Highland Park neighborhoods of Dallas. Cheney served after 1995 as chief executive of Halliburton. His company contracted regularly to provide services to Exxon. Halliburton did not seek to own and produce oil and gas directly, as ExxonMobil did, but made its money by providing construction and engineering services under contract to oil producers, whether they were government-owned companies or private corporations. Socially, Raymond's wife Charlene and Cheney's wife Lynn saw each other not only in Dallas, but at retreats and meetings of the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research, a free market think tank where Raymond served on the board and Lynn served as a senior fellow. When Raymond sat down with Cheney after the latter's swearing-in as vice president, the meeting was best understood as a discussion between like-minded peers and friends who were comparing notes at the cusp of a new project. "Look," Raymond told Cheney, as he recalled it later, "my view is this country is going to be an importer for as far as the eye can see. If you believe that to be the case, what things can we do?" Raymond answered his own question. "The first thing anybody will tell you is you have to have diversification of supply. You can't get yourself in the position where you only have one supplier." That situation had developed between the United States and the Middle East. "To overcome this bottleneck of geopolitical dependency," Raymond said, "the United States had to be engaged every place you can go, even in the North Slope of Alaska." Raymond felt that one of the key issues in foreign policy was how to confront the challenge of increasing access to new oil supplies. As he recalled it, he told Cheney, "We should be trying to encourage, as a matter of foreign policy, having countries develop their natural resources, so that the United States could have as diverse a portfolio of supplies as you can have, so that you don't get yourself beholden to any one person." ExxonMobil had enjoyed easy access to high-ranking government officials during the Clinton administration. When the corporation's Washington representatives needed a meeting, they almost always got one. Raymond told colleagues that ExxonMobil enjoyed access to the administration that was comparable to the halcyon years of the Reagan presidency. Clinton appointees approved the Exxon and Mobil merger with a minimum of fuss. Al Gore's candidacy for the White House, however, had attracted considerable resistance from the oil industry, in part because of Gore's record of environmental activism. Oil and gas companies had donated $34 million to political candidates during the 2000 cycle. More than three-fourths of that funding had gone to Republicans. George W. Bush's father had made his fortune in the oil patch, and the new president had run a wildcatting firm earlier in his career less successfully. There was little mystery about how the Bush administration would proceed on energy policy. A few days before his meeting with Raymond, Bush had assigned Cheney to head a cabinet task force to make rapid recommendations on energy policy. The speed with which the panel planned to issue its findings, just a few months would pass from the panel's formation to the issuance of a finished report, made the initiative recognizable to Washingtonians as one of those pre-cooked packages of policymaking where the authors know much of the outcome in advance. The purpose of such a task force is typically not to deliberate over difficult problems, but to create a process whereby Congress, industry, and the incoming cabinet all become invested in a set of recommendations formally endorsed by a new president. These can then be quickly translated into executive orders, new regulations, and proposed legislation. Cheney ordered the task force to work in secret to protect the prerogatives of the White House, and by doing so he made the task force's work a lightning rod for criticism and conspiracy fears. It took years of litigation to discover, through partial document releases, what intuition might have suggested at the time. Cheney favored energy deregulation and an aggressive push to open up oil and gas production in the United States, and he sympathized with the priorities of Lee Raymond, among other industry executives. James J. Rouse, a United States Army veteran educated in Mississippi who ran ExxonMobil's Washington, D.C. office, attended one of the Cheney panel meetings next door to the White House and presented some of the corporation's forecasts about future global energy demand. It was rising, he noted, and so more oil and gas production would be required. But ExxonMobil did not require access to a mid-level panel staffed by civil servants to make its points to the Bush White House. Lee Raymond flew to Washington about every other month and met privately with Cheney on some of his visits, perhaps two or three times a year. If he needed to make a request or share an observation more urgently than these meetings allowed, all he had to do was pick up the telephone.